Welcome to the Above Politics Show.
Like it or not, we live in times of danger and uncertainty.
Dedicated to intelligent discussion and debate of serious political issues in the U.S. and around the globe.
Absolutely unrealistic.
Borrowing money from China to finance the war in Iraq.
From AbovePolitics.com, this is the Above Politics Show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Above Politics Show. I am Homer Fife.
And I'm Martin Bain, and with us we have a returning special reporter to the show, Nephemore, who is going to talk us through some of the questions and issues around the UK general election. Neph, welcome back to the show.
Hello, how are
welcome
you?
Welcome to the show, Neph.
Yes,
thank you.
It's
thank
been
you.
A great while, and now we can, you know, talk about some really serious politics that isn't going to last sort of from, you know, from now until 2012, when you're going to elect another president in the States. At least our general elections might last 6 months if we're really lucky.
Yeah, six you don't months. Spend hardly any money either.
Yeah, and we do it with civility and decorum as well.
Yeah, sure you do.
Yes. So I suppose it's just worth sort of outlining it that, you know, there is a fixed term in some respects in UK politics.
There is, yeah. It's 5 years from the date of the previous election. And it's variable insofar as the Prime Minister can call an election at any point prior to those 5 years. But in this case, his actual five-year date is, I think, 6th of June.
And then how many days? So is that when he's got to call it? Or presumably he has to call it sometime beforehand. He can't just call in a general election on the 5th of June.
No, he has to give, I think it's 17 days notice, not including weekends. He has to go to Buckingham Palace. It's one of the few things that the Queen actually has left as an absolute power. The Prime Minister has to go to the palace and ask that Parliament is dissolved. And as I say, I think that's 17 days before the election.
And then, well, let me say this. This is fairly interesting. I'm reading here where in the 1960s and 70s, Harold Wilson, the Labour Prime Minister, called a feel-good election after England won the World Cup in 1966. Now, all I got to say is, what's the deal with that? Calling an election because you guys won a sporting event?
Yeah, but I think there's a difference here. In the States, when an election is called or when an election happened is actually governed in law. That's correct, Homer?
That's correct, 100%.
Whereas in the UK, it's the maximum term that is defined in law. Inside that, as Neph has said, the Prime Minister makes the decision when he goes to Buckingham Palace to see the Queen and ask her to dissolve Parliament. He decides with his advisers when he thinks is the best time for him and his party to go to the British people and say, re-elect us. So what Harold Wilson was trying to do after England won the World Cup in 1966 was try and cash in on that one and basically go to the country. People would all be feeling good and they'd vote for more Labour MPs is what Harold Wilson was actually hoping for.
But isn't that kind of a, that's like cheating though, isn't it? I mean,
it's tactical electioneering. It's great. It's happened previously as well. Thatcher rode on the back of the Falklands War.
Yep.
To get re-elected. And they just pick the most favourable time. If the government is in decline and they don't think that they're likely to get through, they will pick a period where people are on holiday. So maybe spring break, or what you would call spring break in the States. Over here, that's usually 2 weeks when the schools are out in the spring. They might go then when there are less people in the country. Or if there's a particular period of bad weather that they think is going to happen or something like that. It's all very tactical. It's very clever.
And there are people who are employed just to advise the political parties or the Prime Minister, you know, when is the right time. They'll be looking at, as Neph says, you know, what's the weather like? You know, what's the economy doing? What are the polls doing? And they'll be having people who will be trying to predict and look at saying, okay, based on weather patterns and this and that, we think it's a good idea to go to the country on a particular date. But I have to say, Neph, it almost seems, you know, since Parliament broke up just before Christmas, I got the impression that everybody was in general election mode from then.
Well, I thought they were going in March, I must admit. And I think a lot of the MPs were gearing up for that. But the latest I've heard now is that they'll be going in May. towards the end of May, I think. I can't give you the actual date, I've been told, just because it would be breaking your confidence.
But I'm surprised that they, because aren't we due council elections in May? So there has been a tradition that, you know, the general election is called at the same time as maybe local government elections.
Yeah, I think that's the way it's going to work. And I think, to be honest, it's to buy Brown some time.
So that he can update his CV?
Well, so he can update his CV. He can also try and get the Labour Party back on side with him, because there's been rumblings recently that they want to replace him, and that they've been panicking. And I think that's why the change has been made from the March one, is to try and get him in a position of some sort of absolute power within the Labour Party to put up a contest. But personally, I think it's a foregone conclusion.
I mean, just from looking at things over here and staying abreast of it as much as I do with the show, I would have to agree with you. I mean, it's a foregone conclusion. I mean, he can put this thing off as long as he wants, or he can do like I was just reading. You guys kind of got me interested in this. Apparently, Tony Blair called an election and only gave everybody like 29 days to campaign. So, you know, I mean, either way, this thing's kind of written in stone with Brown, isn't it?
To be honest, I think Brown could give somebody a year, and if he's still in charge of the Labour Party, then he's going to lose. He is not a popular Prime Minister. It's not to say that he's not been an effective Prime Minister in some of the decisions that he's made, but people don't like him.
Right.
And I can see why. He's sort of a shambling sort of hulk of a man.
And interestingly, you think of where he came from, that he was Tony Blair's Chancellor, and, you know... It pains me a little bit because I've never sort of been comfortable with some of the things he did, but you know, I don't think he made an absolute mess up until he handed over to Alistair Darling of the economy. I do have to say that we did go through a pretty good period of growth when he was, you know, managing the economy and the Chancellor of the Exchequer.
We did, but then we also went into the worst economic depression the world's seen since the 1930s. And there was only one man that was running the finances of the country while all of that was being orchestrated. And that was Gordon Brown.
And I suspect, you know, that, you know, a lot of people are going to take them. One of the interesting things that I've seen here is that, you know, Gordon Brown is not going to be asked to go in front of the Iraq War Inquiry until after the general election. Now, you have to think that, you know, that's probably a pretty shrewd move, because ultimately he implicitly had to go along with Tony Blair in this one, because he was the man that was ultimately signing the checks.
Yeah, and I think when he goes in front of the inquiry, it will be really publicly damaging to the Labour Party. And I think that's another reason why they're not going to get elected, because of the Iraq thing, because of the way they've handled stuff with the economy. I don't think anybody trusts them anymore. They're suffering from the same effect that the Conservatives had in the 80s, or at the end of the 80s. They've been in power for too long.
But the interesting thing is that we have no choice here. We have to elect somebody. And I just wonder whether people are just as hacked off with, you know, the Conservatives, the Liberal Democrats, UKIP, and any other number of parties. I just think there's a, you know, one of the interesting things would be, Neff, if we were to make a prediction of what we thought the turnout might be.
Oh, at less than 50%, probably less than 30%, I would have thought.
What's normal for a good election year for you guys?
Probably just 55, off the top of your head. 55-60%,
something like that. Yeah.
So you guys actually have a pretty good turnout.
Yes, yeah. And no. I would personally, I'd prefer the voting to be mandatory.
Now, guess what? I'm sure many people are going to be, now when they hear that, they're going to be, what? No, I agree with that, Neff, but I'd make one big caveat to that one. If you make it mandatory for people to vote, you should have a box on there that says, I do not think that anybody on the ballot paper above me is worth it. None of the above, the classic Eddie Murphy film. Because then it would be interesting to say, I mean, Australia has mandatory voting, and I think they get something like, is it 98 or 99%? So even then, they don't get it. But at least if someone knows there's 100,000 people who to vote and 98,000 voted, hang on a minute, 52,000 people couldn't even be bothered to vote or said they wouldn't vote for me. I think it changes the way that you interact with your constituency if you knew that over half the people said, I'm not even interested.
I agree. Right. And I was hoping that there was a big push for electoral reform and proportional representation to be brought in. And that's not happened, even though I think that was on the Labour Party manifesto the last time that Blair got elected. They've not done it. And I think the reason that they've not done it is that they've realised that once they bring that sort of thing in, that will break the monopoly of certainly the big two parties. And possibly the Lib Dems would suffer from that as well. I think it's an unwritten understanding that they're going to put that off as far as possible. But yes, I agree. It should be mandatory, and it should have a none of the above on it, just so that people can show that they're disenfranchised. And
yeah, I mean, because to me, I mean, I make the point of going out and going to every election, be it for a parish, local, district, county, or parliamentary, and there are times when I will actually vote for somebody, and there are times when I will do what is called a spoiling the ballot paper, which is making a mark across the whole ballot paper so no one can actually read my vote. Now that's just classed as a spoiled ballot. No one takes account of the fact that, you know, 50% of the ballots were spoiled. That would just be, well, that we're not even going to count them.
Yeah, it's a shame that they don't do that. It's spoiling it, sort of does pander to the idea that the country's full of morons, though, which is a bit of a difficult one to come across. They should have none of the above, and then it would be clear, wouldn't it? It would just be better.
But you can see why if you're on the Great Westminster gravy train, and you know you're from the you're from the Tories or the Labour Party, and maybe to a degree the Liberal Party, who I suspect would probably gain more from proportional representation, because if you think about it, Neff, someone who typically votes Labour and has a second vote is highly unlikely to put Conservative there. They are more likely to put Liberal as their second choice. And if you're a Tory, you're unlikely to put Labour as your second choice. You're going to put Liberal as your second choice. So I can see why they are very keen in that. But, you know, if you're from the big two parties, why would you necessarily want to slit the throats of many of your candidates by not giving them the opportunity?
Well, that's it. But the interesting part about this coming election is that if the swing away from Labour isn't as big as people predict it's going to be, then what will happen is that vote is likely to be split amongst the smaller parties, and it may be that the Conservatives win the election with the assistance of the Liberal Democrats, and that puts them in a wonderful bargaining position. And I'll be interested to see if that actually pans out this time.
I mean, I know there are people who are talking about, you know, what other parties, you know, other than, say, Pride Cymru, Scottish Nationalist parties, and some of the Northern Irish parties, you know, whether there's going to be someone else who's actually going to get a seat. You know, is UKIP going to actually get a seat, one or two seats? You know, is someone like, you know, the British National Party going to get a seat and sort of just throw everything totally, you know, in the pot? You know, it'd be so funny. You know, I don't see anybody from the left theoretically getting any seats. You know, I see more chances of UKIP and the BNP potentially getting seats rather than anybody on the left.
Yeah, I mean, they're the bigger of the smaller parties. Now, I must explain to our American listeners, Plaid Cymru isn't Martin just bringing up phlegm in his throat. It's the name of a Welsh political party. I think, the smaller parties are going to do well. I think that the BNP will probably pick up a couple of seats at the next election, and that is going to make for something of an interesting circus.
And what about UKIP then? Do you think UKIP are going to get any seats? I mean, they're very strong potentially in the southwest of the UK, so, you know, are you thinking that they might get some seats as well?
I think it's possible. It depends. They have just committed politically correctness suicide in Britain, so it's going to be interesting. Whereas the BNP were the bogey party, as it were,
One of the UKIP senior people has just called for a ban on women wearing
the burqa, yes.
Which has put him, you know, as far as the British media goes, will put him up there with Adolf Hitler for a couple of months, and probably will mean that they're going to get a bucket load of negative publicity. There's also the English Democrats, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, they may pick up a seat, although that will be like putting 6 or 7 year olds into a candy box. it's going to be an interesting one. That one is for sure.
And I think one of the interesting questions when we're talking about general elections here, and I suspect we're going to have to explain this to Homer and to our American colleagues, is the West Lothian question.
West Lothian. You're going to have to explain.
I'm going to explain it to you.
Is that Brown's constituency?
No. It's the concept that you know, in the UK we have decisions that are made for the Scotland, the United Kingdom, and typically you'll have laws in Scotland, you'll have laws in England and Wales, and the concept there is that there are people who are elected to make decisions in Scotland who will make decisions that will impact, who are elected into Scottish constituencies who will make decisions that only impact people in the UK and Wales, in yes. England and Wales. And it's always this, they call it the West Lothian question. So, you know, it's basically
terminology I hadn't come across before.
Ah.
That one. So you've caught me out there.
Hey, it's an interesting thing that, you know, especially with the Scottish Parliament, you know, yes. that there are Scottish MPs in Westminster who can make decisions that impact me and you, because you and I live in England, but they could not make a decision that would impact somebody in Scotland.
Yes, and interesting thing about this election is that Cameron is actually English, whereas Blair and Brown had Scottish heritage. So he's got a lot of things going for him at the moment, David Cameron, hasn't he? He's an English guy going for Parliament at a time of, what's the best way of putting it, an uprising nationalism in the country.
I think that's very well put, Neff. That I think you're right. There is probably a swing to the right of English politics. I think would be saying. I think there is a general feeling that, you know, that's the way we want. Which then sort of always leads me on to a little bit about some of the discussions of some of the key issues. And one of the things that always annoys me about once the election is called, is that the issues aren't set by us, the people who are going to vote. They're set by the parties that then decide, right, choose the first Tuesday after the election, the Conservatives will be profiling health, the Labour Party will do education, and the Liberal Democrats will do defence. And they're trying to vie with the media to say that, oh, but my issue is more important than anybody else's. And it's listening, you know, how many people actually are interested in that. Most people are interested in is my job safe? Will I be able to keep a roof over my head? Oh, and by the way, when I go to the NHS, do I get seen quickly? And most people, you know, if you actually think about what the parties try and tell us are the important issues, I suspect most people in the country don't actually care.
Yeah, I would say so. The interesting thing about this time, though, is that for the first time, and I'm amazed that it is for the first time, they're going to have a debate between the leaders of the three main parties on television, mirroring the American way of doing things, which that's going to be interesting, especially if they take questions from the floor.
Which Homer, correct me if I'm wrong here, I think the presidential elections are so sanitized that do they actually have any real value?
It depends on what you call sanitized.
The questions are known in advance. There's nobody in the audience who's going to put their hand up and ask a question.
No, never. Never. It's not allowed, especially at the Democrat and the Republican National Conventions, the two main conventions. Everything's already written in stone, more or less. Now, there have been surprises, but I don't believe in my lifetime. But, you know, back in the 50s and 60s, prior to me being, any, you know, even aware of elections, there were some surprises during the conventions, but nothing like what you're talking about. Now, the wonder of your politics is the fact that you do have kind of a free-for-all atmosphere where pretty much anybody can get involved, but not here. No.
Yeah, I mean, you know, something that I'm going to be looking forward to, Neff, is, you know, are the candidates for my constituency, which is my area in which is going to be represented in Westminster, you know, they will potentially knock on our doors and try and convince us to go and vote for them, which I think is a great thing, because it gives, you know, if some guy wants to knock on my door and say, oh, by the way, the most important, oh yes, I'm from so and so party, and the most important things that we see are bang, 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 well, I can just look at him and go, well, guess what, they're not actually that important for me, and then you get the opportunity to enter into a dialogue.
Yeah, I have vowed this time that if any of my MPs come and knock on the door, the first question will be, how much did you claim in expenses? And that is something that I think people aren't going to have forgotten in this election. And it's going to be interesting.
And you're absolutely right. And I think one of the things we're seeing this time is that there are going to be more new MPs in Westminster at the end of this at the end of the general election than there have been probably since Parliament was formed.
Yeah, and the other interesting notion is that we may have a number of completely independent MPs this time. If you remember, a couple of British celebrities have said that they were going to run to get elected. I think Esther Ranson was one. The newsreader guy whose name I can't remember,
Martin Bell.
Yes, there were a few of them who were really upset with the expenses thing, and they've said that they would stand this time, and that will be interesting to see if they get in.
But traditionally, if we look at both, say, the US and UK politics, because I was listening to the radio today, listening to an independent senator from the sort of socialist leanings in the States, that typically independents don't actually do very well, either in UK politics or in US politics.
Yeah, Martin Bell did, though, didn't he, if you think about it? He got in there once, I think, didn't he?
And yeah, then he got in, but we've never seen a groundswell of, you know, 10 or 11 independent MPs in the UK. And Homer, I don't think there are probably a handful of independent senators and representatives.
No, a handful would be pushing it, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, it's typically, if you're not part of one of the big parties, you know, wherever you are in the US or the UK, Europe is probably, with proportional representation, is probably getting closer to that, where an independent has a greater chance, or a coalition of independents have a greater chance of achieving anything.
Mm. Yeah, I think, well, going back to the expenses thing, the Facebook group that was set up about the expenses, I think in the end it had something like 500,000 members. That's a large chunk of the electorate, if you think about it.
And typically, if you think of Facebook, is probably more, you know, probably Facebook is a much more younger thing. You know, it's typically going to be people, you know, maybe up to 35 or 40 who are going to be on Facebook. It's not going to be people 45 and above who are going to be on Facebook. When you think about it, it's probably an even bigger percentage of people who maybe haven't voted, or this is going to be their, you know, this is the first time they are voting.
Well, guys, let me, I don't know what it's like over there, but as you know, exactly what Martin's saying is the rule over here. Your large voting block over here is 40 and above. As a general rule, people under 40, particularly under the age of 30, don't vote. So, you know, if you're a politician, regardless of whether you're independent or not, would you try to appeal to that group on Facebook, or would you tend to go more mainstream into the news media? I mean, it's a no-brainer. If you want to be elected, you have to appeal to the 40-plus age group.
Well, I think in this country, and to an extent, you had it in the States. You had a viral election campaign, and this is going to be the first viral general election in the UK. And there are a lot of important issues for younger people who, in a lot of respects now, are getting treated almost like second-class citizens. The school leaving age has been raised. They have to get grants for their continuing education, student loans that they end up paying back over 10 or 15 years through their life. And, you know, these people are looking at things and saying, hang on a minute, we're getting shafted. And I think there's going to be quite a young turnout this time. I think people are fed up, especially to do things like the war in Afghanistan and, you know, Iraq.
The kids don't want to see that anymore. They're fed up with it. And, you know, there is a lot of voices saying that now. I think that'll come out this time.
But if you look at, say, UK politics, and I think we can also make the parallel to the US politics in that, in some respects, all that happens is that, you know, the leaders of the party say, oh, well, let's go and appeal to the youth. But does anything actually change? If you think about, you know, Barack Obama got elected probably because there was a great job done in getting, you know, the coloured vote on board and the younger vote on board. But does that mean that anything in US politics has actually changed because more young people and more coloured people voted than any other election?
Well, first off, they're called black people. And I just want to be politically correct here. We don't use the color term anymore.
But two countries separated by the same
language. Yes,
exactly. But more importantly, I think my opinion now, and having followed the elections for as long as I have, as deeply as I have, I consider myself to be fairly accurate. I don't think you saw as much of that as people expected. I don't think Obama was elected because of an increase in the black vote. I also don't think he was elected because of an increase in the younger vote. I think he was elected because there was no other choice. I think that when push come to shove, a lot of people who made verbal comments that I wouldn't vote for a black man, you know, a lot of the racism that is still prevalent here in the United States never reared its head because those same people looked at the choices and realized there wasn't a choice. So, you know, I mean, you had McCain, who's nothing but a rhino, which, for those of you who don't know, stands for Republican in name only. And he's an idiot at best and a complete moron at worst. And you had Obama, and they elected the lesser of two evils.
But hang on, but you had independent candidates. You had, I think there were five people on the ballot paper.
There's always five or six independent candidates, Martin, but they don't get the time of day. And a large part of the problem is the independent candidates themselves. I mean, you got a large following of Ron Paul on AboveTopSecret.com, but that doesn't tell you anything. I mean, Ron Paul's out there. He's out there somewhere in cyberspace. You know, he wants to take the world back to the 1700 way of viewing the Constitution. And I'm sorry, Ron, I hate to break it to you, but it is 2010, and we can't step back five decades just to please you. You know, you've got the Greenpeace candidate who doesn't want us to cut trees down, or, you know, if you go outside in the middle of the night and take a leak in your yard, you're going to get arrested because you've killed some grass. Okay, so, you know, that's the problem with the independent candidates. We have never had a viable independent candidate run in my lifetime in the United States. They're always freaks.
Ross Perot,
yes.
Ross Perot was a freak. Now, granted, his basic foundation was good because he's probably one of the best businessmen. Well, not probably. I mean, he's proven himself to be one of the best businessmen in the world. But have you listened to him? Did you listen to him? He has no concept of the political structure of the United States. He has no idea of foreign policy. His foreign policy would have drug us back, not centuries, but it would have drug us back to World War II type of policies. You know, I took a hard look at him, you know, and that's hard to do with his ears. But, you know, let's face it, the man's ideas were out there. No, he was not a viable candidate. I'm talking about a viable, electable candidate. You know, the closest thing that we've had has been a Lieberman. You know, Lieberman was, and now he is an independent. He did change his policies from Democrat to independent. He's thoughtful. He's thought-provoking. He's intelligent, and he's an independent. But he'll never run for president because he's Jewish and he knows he'll never win.
Which I think is, and then in the UK now, it's somewhat different in the fact that we don't elect the president or prime minister in that sense of the word. We elect a candidate locally who is then attached to a party, and then the leader of the party who has either the most votes or who indicates to Buckingham Palace that they can form a government is then the prime minister. So, you know, it's always interesting to see that we do have a very different political structure in the States, that we do not elect the prime minister directly.
Yeah, that upsets a lot of people as well these days. And I don't know why. The number of comments you'll see, even on ATS, you know, Brown wasn't elected. Well, no, the Labour Party was elected. Gordon Brown happens to lead the Labour Party, which makes him the Prime Minister. And that's where the name comes from. He's the leader of the ruling party.
Yeah, he's the Prime Minister. He traditionally also came from the fact that he was the monarch's Prime Minister. He was the monarch's
Prime Minister. All right, but guys, hold on a second. Answer me this, Neff. Then how much different, really, in all honesty, is our two systems? Because you elect the party then appoints the leader, correct?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. We elect the leader who is, by all intents and purposes, the leader of that party.
But he's not, though, is he?
Absolutely. Barack Obama, because he's a pansy. But if you go back to George Bush... You know, George Bush was the leader of the Republican Party. He was strong. Yeah, he led the party.
How long was he the leader of the party?
For the whole eight years he was in.
I'll tell you why. Yeah, but that's the whole 8 years he's in. To somebody in England or to somebody in Britain, the American political system is a bit of a mystery because...
We're a mystery? I haven't understood half the stuff you and Martin have said.
Let me finish. Half the people who end up being the president of the United States... nobody has ever heard of prior to them being the president of the United States. That's the people in England. Nobody in England had heard of Barack Obama until a year before he was elected president of the United States.
Well, that's okay. Nobody in the United States had heard of him either. I mean, he'd never done anything, but, you know.
Well, that's what I'm saying, you see. Now, in England, the party leaders are usually party leaders for 4 or 5 years prior to an election, and people know who they are. And in some respects... that makes the system a little bit the same, because you could certainly argue that in the case of Tony Blair, he was the leader of the Labour Party before he was elected. And Tony Blair being the leader of the Labour Party is probably what got them elected, because up until that point, they were a bunch of left-wing dinosaurs that, you know, nobody wanted to have anything to do with.
But here's what's happening. You guys, and I'm going to throw some compliments your way, Neff, you guys have a much cleaner political party. If you pulled one of the leaders of our political party out and put him up for election, he'd get killed because everybody knows him. They know all the dirt in his closet. See, we want people that can possibly hide some of that dirt before they get elected because, I mean, you look at the leaders of our political party. You got Nancy Pelosi on the Democrat side. You've got Newt Gingrich coming out right now on the Republican side. These people have been vetted, and we know what they are, and nobody's going to vote for them. So, hey.
Do you not think that's quite bizarre? You end up making the most powerful person, arguably the most powerful person on the planet, if you discount the president of Russia and the leader of the Communist Party in China, is a complete and utter nobody. Prior to... not a nobody, but do you know what I mean? They are,
I think it would be fair to say that, you know, and I think Homer's touched on it, that, you know, other than in his own state, President Barack Obama was probably absolutely unknown outside of the out of the Washington elite and his own state. I mean, right. You know, and I can see where Neff is coming from here. At least, you know, we will have seen and had the opportunity to get the measure of David Cameron, Nick Clegg, you know, in Westminster, because we will have seen them at Prime Minister's Question Time when they will be asking Gordon Brown questions. So, you know, we will have seen them. We've seen them on TV for, as Neff says, anywhere up to 2 to 5 years beforehand. So we get an opportunity to see the mettle of the person, and you know all this. You know, and there'll no doubt be press releases and
okay. But
videos.
Now let's not throw away the fact too that while the president of the United States may be considered the most powerful man in the world. That power is extraordinarily limited. I mean, let's face it. Everything is being blamed on Barack Obama. He just blames back on Bush. Okay, and it's been that way. And, of course, everything that Bush did was blamed on Bush. And now everything that Obama's doing is being blamed. The whole point of the matter is a sitting president of the United States does not, in fact, have that much power. Okay? They just, you know, their power is derived from the Congress and the Senate. literally the most they can do is they can send troops into an area under limited conditions for a certain amount of time. They can't enact laws. They cannot submit legislation. So in all honesty, they are a figurehead. But, you know, that's why I haven't, you haven't heard me lambast Obama maybe as much as some people would have thought I would have because of his mistakes. But, you know, the stuff that he supports gets carried through. But for all intents and purposes, his power is very limited, where I'm assuming your prime minister has a lot more power over there.
That's actually, it's the first time I've ever contemplated that. But pound for pound, what you've just told us is that the British prime minister actually wields more power.
Yes.
Than the American president does. Because
yes, and also consider this, Neff, consider this, and then I'll let you get your point out. I'm sorry, but this is important. I want you to consider how many decisions are made here by our president based upon your prime minister. You guys hold a tremendous amount of not power, but what's the word I'm looking for?
Prestige.
Yeah, it's a prestige. I mean, we look at you guys and your decisions are generally thought-provoking and generally held to a better standard worldwide than ours are. So you have a lot of influence on what goes on over here. So, yeah, I think, and I want to hear your comments on this, I think your prime minister holds more power than our president.
I think you're right. I think prior to the invasion of Iraq, the only country's opinion that mattered to the American public was Britain's. And I think that the world was waiting to see what the British Prime Minister was going to do and whether we were going to back you or not. And I don't think you would have gone into Iraq if we'd have said no.
I agree.
Because of the influence. And it's odd. I'm just sitting here thinking about sort of real sort of power and wielding real power. And when it comes to like the nuclear weapons and stuff like that, your president has the authority to launch them, doesn't he? Whereas in Britain, the actual authority to launch is down to the submarine commanders on a letter from the Prime Minister. And I'd never really thought about the power structures like that, which is very strange.
But I think just taking Homer's point and what he's actually saying is that I think in many respects you're absolutely right, Homer, because Gordon Brown can decide that he wants to enact a piece of legislation. He then hands it over to the relevant minister, who then gets his civil servants to create it, do the white paper, green paper, the whole process. And then the prime minister can then go to his whips, who are, let's call whips, are basically the enforcers or the police officers of each party, who make sure that members of that party do what they're told. So in some respects, Homer's absolutely right here. Gordon Brown can say, right, I want a piece of legislation that says every third Tuesday of July is going to be Gordon Brown Day.
There's your power. Exactly, Martin. There's the power.
Gordon Brown could actually, if he wanted to force that through using the mechanism, he could force that through because he has the apparatus and the party and the machine to actually do that.
And Barack Obama cannot do that. He is prohibited by law from doing that. See, because we have three separate entities that run this country. We have the legislative branch, the executive branch, which is Obama, and I forget what the third one is. Okay, I'm an idiot. But regardless, the third one doesn't count.
Judiciary? The judges?
That's right, the judiciary, right, the judges. Okay, so those three are separate. So being an executive, the actually head of the executive branch of the government, Obama is prohibited by law from presenting legislation. And that's where your power's at, guys. Am I wrong about this? I mean, that's it. Passing laws. That's the power.
I think you're right. And as I say, it's something that I've never particularly considered before, but yeah.
Although, interestingly though, but Barack Obama does have a power. Doesn't he have to sign every act of Congress?
He can sign, veto, or ignore. However, if he ignores it, it goes back for another vote, and you need a simple majority, and that can be, it can be pushed through without his signature.
Okay.
He can veto it, and you need a supermajority, but that's happened before. They don't use the veto very often, and I'll tell you why. They don't want to extraordinarily upset either side of the House or Senate, and the veto tends to do that. I think, don't quote me on this, but I think George Bush maybe used the veto power twice in his entire time in office, and I don't know that Obama's done it yet.
Wow. Okay. I mean, yes, you're right. I mean, and certainly one of the things that we try and do with this show is sort of maybe provoke people's thoughts. And I think some of the comments that you've just made, Homer, I think, you know, have made me think about things slightly differently. And I suspect from what Nev's just said, you know, I think we have always assumed that the President of the United States is one of the most powerful men in the world. I think he's powerful because he potentially has at his fingertips a very powerful and effective military. But beyond that, that's probably about the only power that the US president actually has, is that he can order troops to go to certain places in certain circumstances.
All right, here you go, guys. Barack Obama has not vetoed anything as a regular veto across his desk yet. He has done one pocket veto, which I have no idea.
And I'm sure if we ask somebody to tell us what a pocket veto is, there'll be somebody at Above Top Secret who will go on to this thread and say, hey, guys, this is what it is. So, you know, that's something we appreciate.
In 8 years, George W. Bush vetoed 11 times with one pocket veto, and four of those were overridden.
Wow.
Just to give you an example, Bill Clinton did 36, which doesn't surprise me. Well, no, not for any purposes against Clinton, but the very fact that for the majority of Clinton's time in, he faced a Republican Senate and a Republican Congress. So
I'm just trying to think. I don't think we can necessarily use Gordon Brown as that one, but I'm trying to think how many times was Tony Blair thwarted by, you know, his own party or the House of Lords?
Once. And I'm trying to once, and I'm trying to think what it was.
I am as well. I know there was one thing I think he was thwarted on, and I think it was probably sent back and changed in line with that. So you're absolutely right.
ID cards.
There you are. One thing. Wow. So and
now here's an interesting thing. Franklin Roosevelt, who was president during the big war, had 635 total vetoes.
but I wonder how many of those were, you know, someone putting something through that says you must do so and so, or you must do something for this small country, and he just turned around and said, yeah,
yes,
it's not going to happen. But
probably, yeah.
But yeah, no, I think whenever Gordon Brown goes to the Buckingham Palace and asks the Queen to dissolve Parliament, you know, from my point of view, we are already in an election mode. That is absolutely obvious to me. You only have to see, you know, the huge kerfuffle over, you know, Cameron saying he's going to put tax breaks in for married couples and everybody jumping on that one. You know, it clearly is obvious to me that these guys are now absolutely fighting for who is going to occupy Downing Street.
Just an aside, getting back to the veto, I just found out something interesting just to let our readers know, our listeners know. When I said something about a pocket veto is when the president vetoes a bill when Congress is not in session. And what that means is that's it. It can't get overridden. That's it. It's done. That kills it.
That's clever.
Very clever. Very interesting. Okay, very so back.
Going back to what Martin was saying, and it ties in with this nicely, the dark horse in this election this time is going to be Nick Clegg. And Nick Clegg is the leader of the Liberal Democrat Party. And the reason that he's the dark horse is because he is very much the Barack Obama of the UK political system, insofar as nobody has particularly heard of him.
I think you're right. He is more unknown, but you know everyone keeps on saying that, you know, this is going to be the breakthrough election for the Liberal Democrats. And, you know, I've heard that, golly, ever since I've been cognizant of general elections, that, you know, you've always heard, you know, yep, this is going to be the breakthrough election. And I can remember David Steele or Lord David Steele saying it. I can remember Paddy Ashdown saying it. I can remember Charles Kennedy saying it. You know, all these people have said, this is it. We are going to become, you know, a serious third party, or we may even become the opposition. And it's just never happened.
I think because of the way the voting's likely to go away from Labour, it could actually happen. The Liberal Democrats finance guy is a guy called Vince Cable.
Yes.
And he is possibly
the single most engaging politician I've seen in British politics for best part of 20 years.
And he's somebody I have repeatedly put requests into the Liberal Democrat Central Office, and I have to agree with you there, Neff. Yeah, he is a guy, I listen to him on the radio, and he always seems to talk sense, and I think, hang on a minute, he understands what was going, he articulated the economic crisis. He actually, you know, and I was thinking, actually, this guy, yes, he could be credible. It's interesting that he's not the party leader.
Yeah, I think, I don't think he actually wanted to be at the time. I think he was kind of testing the water a little bit. But it's the same, almost the same as the Blair and Brown team that got elected first off, is that you've got the face in Nick Clegg and the brains in Vince Cable. But the thing with Vince Cable, as opposed to Brown, is that he can actually talk the talk as well as walk it. And I'm hoping that, you know, they pick up. And I think he would make a great party leader, Vince Cable. And I hope that he gets there eventually.
Yeah, I mean, I think the interesting thing is whether if, as you think, and I have to agree with you to a degree that I think that the Labour Party are probably going to get a bit of a spanking. It's a question of whether people who have voted Labour are going to turn around and say, actually, I'm going to vote totally opposite and I'm going to vote Conservative, or are they going to think, hang on a minute, I think there is that middle ground, I'm going to go and talk to, you know, I'm going to go and talk to the Liberal Democrats and see what they can do for me. And that's the thing that, you know, is I've often had the impression in the UK that, you know, people are very black and white with how they vote, that, you know, it's probably, I reckon it's probably less than a million people probably decide who is actually going to be the next Prime Minister, because most people will probably vote as they voted last time and the election before that and the election before that. It's the small percentage of swing voters that actually make the difference.
Yeah, they do. And I think this time out, anybody who is bold enough to stand up and say, I'm going to cut fuel duty and I'm going to do something about immigration and I'm going to fix the transport system, is likely to get themselves elected. And I've yet to come across a party that has actually said any of that. It's bizarre.
It is, and you know, and I suppose it's just, you know, I know we are getting close to time, so I think, you know, we will be wrapping up. But you know, it's interesting as to what are the big issues. You know, and clearly, I think, yeah, and people are no doubt going to flame me, immigration is going to probably be one of the biggest issues that has faced this country since Enoch Powell's, you know, Rivers of Blood speech. You know, there seems to be a groundswell that people, you know, want to ask our leaders, you need to do something about the number of people in this country. You know, and fine, people are probably going to class, oh, well, you must be racist or right wing for thinking that. But, you know, there are many countries across the world, and in particular, I raise the example of Australia, which is fairly harsh on who comes into their country.
Well, every country in Europe, apart from Britain, has some sort of closed immigration policy. Even France tend to pass them through to Britain. That's why there's so much of a problem with the security on the Channel Tunnel. And yeah, I agree. That's going to be a big issue this time.
But I just wonder, people will, I think, reflect on the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, but I wonder just how much of an issue that will actually be. Whether people, when they're sitting in that little cubicle and they've got a piece of paper in front of them, you know, are they actually going to think, actually, no, I can't vote for the Labour Party candidate because Tony Blair sent us to war in Iraq and Afghanistan? I don't see that as making the decision when you're actually sitting there in that polling booth.
Maybe, unless you're in a military town. If it's somewhere like Hereford or, you know,
Colchester. Or Aldershot
The place recently that's been in the news because of the Wootton Bassett, you know, those people are not going to vote Labour because they're the people that see the dead bodies and they're the people that see the coffins and they're the people that are asking the questions as to why actually are we doing this. And there's another upshot to that as well, which is the finances, and it's something that plays on my mind. You know, the country is financially battered. The money's got to come back from somewhere. And what have we just signed on to do? Build two aircraft carriers, £1.6 billion.
why do we need those?
Yes.
We don't need them. We don't at the moment.
I think I'm not sure whether people, when they come to make decisions about who they're going to elect at their constituency level, are necessarily going to be thinking, hang on a minute, we can afford to spend £1.6 billion on a couple of aircraft carriers. I think what people are going to be more interested in is, why did we give £1.2 trillion to the banks, yet they still feel it's appropriate to pay millions of pounds in bonuses? I suspect that is going to be of more of an issue. I suspect it's going to be people who are more informed of the political landscape, like you, who are going to think, hang on, why can we afford to spend billions of pounds on an aircraft carrier? The average man in the street probably doesn't perceive that we're actually building two aircraft carriers.
Well, that's the thing is, and I use that as an example, sooner or later the average man in the street is going to be forced to perceive that, because the general election will kick in probably at the same time as the local government elections. And what's going to be a big issue this year are council tax rises and budget cuts in public sector spending. And that is when things are going to start hitting home, because people are already noticing that I mentioned the transport network earlier. The roads are falling apart. It's a big issue now because of the winter that we're having. If we get more snow, more ice, more problems, what happens is that the roads clog up, the councils run out of salt, they can't afford the winter maintenance functions that they're supposed to be doing. But also, the follow-on from that is that the road network itself will fall to pieces, and there is no money to fix it. And the reason that there's no money to fix it is because it's been spent elsewhere. And I think people are going to start noticing it more now. And finance is going to be a big issue this time, definitely. Finance, immigration, terrorism, possibly.
Terrorism. I mean, I think the health service is always a perennial one. Health and education are always two that I think motivate people, purely because, that impacts, if you have children, if you don't have children yourself, you're going to have friends who have children. So therefore, making sure that they're educated, and making sure that you can get access to healthcare, those are probably two of the big issues that are actually going to impact people. But one of the things I say is, you have a once in a 4 or 5 year opportunity in the UK now that you are going to be getting either party activists or even your sitting MP or someone who wants to be your MP is potentially going to knock on your door and is going to, if they're sensible, they're going to ask you for your vote. You have an opportunity to challenge and debate those individuals so that you can make a decision. And to me, that is one of the joys of the democratic system that we enjoy here, is that some man, some woman is going to knock on my door and basically say, I'm from XYZ party, I'd like you to vote for me. And I've got the opportunity to either say, ha, you must be joking, or okay, but, and that is something that I hold very precious.
Yeah, I agree. And it's going to make for some interesting conversations over the next couple of months, I'm sure.
I can absolutely see that. Well, I know we have come close to time. We're going to be all running 55 minutes for the show, so I want to thank you very much, Neff, for taking the time to join us, and hopefully as we continue down the election track, we'll maybe get you on and we can sort of talk some more about the what's going on with the election campaign.
Yeah,
absolutely.
It's been great
having you, buddy.
Cheers. Yes.
Really is good news. So I just want to say, if you've got any comments, find the show thread in the Above Politics forum. I noticed the last one, that was my fault. I put it up in Regional Politics, but I guess most of you are sharp enough to find it. But yeah, if you've got any comments, you know what to do. Find the show thread and post away.
That's correct, and especially remember that Martin is probably going to vote for the BNP.
Oh,
this is Home of the Fife. Thank you for listening to our show.
Yes, thank you very much for that, Homer. I'm Martin Bain, and we'll see you next time on the Above Politics Show.
You've been listening to the Above Politics Show. If you have a comment, suggestion, or an opposing view, please deliver it at abovepolitics.com.
The views expressed on the Above Politics show do not necessarily reflect the staff and management of the Above Network LLC or any of its affiliates. Thanks for listening, and please continue to deny apathy.